After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
I think that alternative communities are potential role models for the game. And I think that they are great experimental situations for us to examine a lot of our ideals when they're made manifest. And it's hard to run a community when you have only individuals. There has to be the sense of surrender into the common good as well.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with Ram Dass here and now, a new episode. And before I get into it, a couple of announcements. One is that we have this wonderful new book, Whisper in the Heart, that's coming out in August, and it's ready for pre-orders, which really help us when you pre-order the book. It starts to put it on the map so that the people who carry these books, our books in particular, will make sure they're well stocked so they people can find them. So this is a nice contribution. If you can do it, pre-order it. And to do that, by the way, you just go to shop.ramdass.org and you click through the main banner to the pre-order. And this book is done by Parvati Marcus, a mother of my children, who put that wonderful book together, Love Everyone, about all of our stories of getting to India back in the day. That's a marvelous book, by the way, if you don't have it, also available in the shop. But this book tells the stories of people who met Neem Karoli Baba after he left that body. And Maharaji always said, a true guru, it's not necessary to mate in the physical body. And this book proves it. It shows all the myriad of ways in which he contacts his devotees, you know, through directly in physical presence, through dreams, through visions, through a book. It's amazing. So there's just great stories in this book. So again, just go to shop.ramdass.org and click through the banner to the pre-order page. So that would be a great thing and a great help. By the way, there's a wonderful article that we sent out the other day that Rachel Fisher put together, Caring for Family as a Spiritual Practice, which has a talk from Ram Dass as well. Very beneficial stuff. This was much of what he talked about was how he went back to care for his father when he was moving towards the end of his life. So it's just such a beautiful thing. I'd love to share it out with people. You can find it on ramdass.org or go in your mail. And if you're not getting mail from us, the wonderful newsletters that Rachel puts out every week, just make sure it's not caught in the old spam bucket, okay? Take a look. And last but not least, a retreat, August 25th through 29th in Boone, North Carolina, in the middle of the Blue Ridge Mountains, is taking place then. It's headlined by Krishna Dass, but Bob Thurman is going to be there, Sharon Salzberg via Zoom, East Forest with his fantastic music, Spring Washam, a wonderful teacher and someone who's into both meditative practice and shamanism, is going to be there. I will be there. Duncan's going to Zoom in with me. And as I said, East Forest will be there with his partner doing movement practices in the woods. It's going to be delightful. And Nina Rao is going to be there, and she's going to do join us in sessions and do her chalisas. And Benji Wertheimer is going to be there, phenomenal musician. He's going to be playing with Krishnadas, and he's also going to be doing something with his wife, Heather, doing some music from Shantala. Okay, here it is. This is a continuation of the last podcast we did. It's with this guy, Duncan Campbell, that Ram Dass appeared on his show Connections at KGNU in Boulder. This is from 1994. The first question, this is obviously something Ram Dass was asked many, many, many times. It's cute how he describes it. And that was, how do you keep your head straight amidst all of the love that's being thrown at you and all the advice that's being asked for? It's weird because these days Ram Dass isn't here, and we get a lot of mail at info@ramdass.org. And, you know, collectively we try and answer as much of it as we can. And I'm sometimes left with the bag, so to speak, of trying to help as best I can. I am not Ram Dass. But one time I was responding to a Q&A that a magazine had asked Ram Dass for, and he said, look, you put some answers together and I'll approve it. How about that? And I did all of that. And then he turned to me after I sent it to him. He called me and he went, not bad. Not bad. That was one of the great compliments from him to me. But yeah, so he just talks about it, you know, that he's, remember, he used to talk about how he's a rent-a-mouth, and people shouldn't confuse the cup with the tea. Oh, it's so great. What else is in here? This is cool. The revolution in telecommunications and the information superhighway. Someone asked what his thoughts on that are. I mean, you know, what he talked about was so right on for where we are at right now. It's just uncanny to hear. He explores the nature. How about this? He explores the nature of virtual reality and virtual reality community and how that medium can affect our relationships. I mean, we're just talking now about, you know, the metaverse and how we should get involved, Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, to be able to hold satsang on the metaverse. He talked about it in 93 or 94. Anyhow, it's the thing that struck me there, this particular phrase he used, that this might, he said, turn into a major democratization process that nobody is going to be able to control. Blockchain, anyone? Unbelievable. What else? I'm just going to highlight a couple more things. The thing that strikes the bell with me in this talk is him talking about the cultivation of compassion, where you appreciate what the mainstream consciousness is about and why those people are the way they are, instead of making them into them. They're a part of us. How do we get there? And that's been a project of mine with my friend Duncan Trussell through my Mind Rolling podcast. We are really getting to the bottom of what we're doing, which Krishnadas called the movie of me. So we're trying to get from the movie of me to the movie of us. And Ram Dass addresses this directly. Wonderful, wonderful part of this talk, really. What else? Oh, the other thing that struck me in here was somebody asked about Christian. They heard a Christian preacher on the radio and feel like he was leading people astray, and asked Ram Dass if he ever had a chance to speak with Christian clergy. And he said he had spoken with them and found ways to connect around their love of the teachings of Christ without getting lost in Christianity. Well, When I first went to India, this is a famous story. Many of you already probably know the story, but and it's been told by Krishnadas as well as Ramdas. And that was, I, and so is Ramdas, and so is Krishnadas, come from Jewish heritage. And we went there. I never had read the New Testament. I had no connectivity to Christ whatsoever. And one of the first things Maharaji said, "Where's your cross? You're not wearing a cross?" Ultimately, by the way, in the end, we kind of felt like, okay, when you're in the undivided state, there are no Jews and Christians. They all come from the same deal. You know what I mean? Jesus was Jewish. But one day I said to him, I figured I've got my guru. I'm all set to go. Literally in the first few days, I said, Maharaji, instead of saying, "Can you give me a mantra," which would have maybe made things easier, I said, "How do I meditate?" And he stopped and he said, "Meditate like Christ." When he was on the cross, he felt no pain. He was lost in love. And then Ramdas, who wasn't there in that moment, came along and I told him what had happened and said, "You have a more convivial relationship with Maharaji, maybe you can ask, well, how did Christ meditate?" And he did that. And the famous story, Maharaji just became that vibration of what Christ is. And he just, tears came to his eyes as he, we were all like blown away. And he kept saying over and over, "You don't understand. He never died." I mean, over and over and over, "You don't understand. He never died. He was lost in love with every sentient being." And, he was there for all of us. We got such a huge download of the reality of Christ's complete selfless concern for others, which is what Maharaji ultimately gave all of us during that time. So thanks much, everybody. Thanks much for being here and being part of our podcast network. Just go to BeHereNowNetwork.com, and we have so many incredible teachers and thought leaders and podcasts. Please do take advantage of them, and we'll see you next time. Ram Ram.
Let's take some calls. Tank, you're on the air.
Hi, Ramdas, I have a question for you. You're famous, and people want you to everywhere to speak, and they listen to you as some kind of a channel for truth and ask you advice about how to live their lives and so on. How do you keep your head straight?
Well,
or don't you?
It's an interesting question. When I start a lecture, I usually say that my name Ramdas means servant of God, but Ram is also an acronym for rent-a-mouth, and that basically what I am is a mouthpiece for a process a lot of us are going through. And so I diffuse the idea that I know and other people don't, because I look out at my audiences of people I meet, and they know what I know. It's just that I say it well, and I don't think that you should confuse the cup with the tea. It's I'm the cup, I'm not the tea. And the tea is the eternal truth, and all I got to do is get out of the way to do it. And every time I get in the way and try to rip it off for my ego, it turns into a very kind of empty form for me. And I, the early years, I loved people throwing flowers in front of me and applauding and all that. And then I began to see that I was still desperately lonely as a human being if I was going to count on that as my gratification. So I really think I've grown beyond that now, and I think it's an interesting issue to work with.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tank. I also just wanted to share a story. I was once at a conference with John Bradshaw, and he was asked the same question now that he's become very popular and speaks to hundreds of thousands of people a year. And he talked about having a men's group in Houston that he's belonged to of six people for the last 5 or 6 years, and he says, "Those guys keep me straight,
Yeah.
If I tend to get carried away by that immense seduction yeah. of all of that energy and approval coming at me, they try to ground me and say, "You're just John," and
yeah.
here's...
I surround myself with people who bust me all the time. I mean, that's a big secret, to mm-hmm. really empower people around you, and if they empower you, to bust each other. And we have these groups that meet. I'm meeting on one with one next week in New Mexico, a group that meets twice a year. Mm-hmm. We just meet for 3 or 4 days, and we're all peers, and we have no agenda other than to be together. And we do circle sharing, and it's amazing how straight it all gets.
That's very interesting, because I had a sense that Ralph Metzger might be a friend like that for you at the conference, the way he talked about your friendship over the years.
Well, Ralph and I, of course, go back to Harvard after days, but we're not actively spending time together now.
I see. But still, there was a sense I got his speaking that, you know, there's a real peer level, there's a friendship.
Rascals always know one another.
That's right. Let's go to David on the air here. David?
Good morning, Ram Dass. It's nice to have you in Boulder.
Thank you, David.
Seems like the future, our future, is being defined by the revolution in telecommunications and the information superhighway, and it's so vast and unknowable that it just boggles the brain to even think about what it might mean for us. But I would be interested to ask for your thoughts on the implications of all of this information and all of this access to the future, the short-term future and long-term future.
It's a really interesting question, David, and I share with you the feeling that I don't know. I can feel that what is required is that from moment to moment I stay as quiet in my mind and open as possible to hear the gestalt anew, because the whole process is changing so fast. For example, the nature of time, the way in which people understand time, there's some very profound changes through the information age. The implications of that run off and off and off and off and off into infinite number of permutations. So I can't really say that. I can say that we are still functioning, as you know, on a post-industrial mentality, and we haven't really gotten up to the information. For example, the nature of community, which is something I've been thinking about and lecturing about a little bit. What is virtual reality community? What does it not have? What does it have? I have a foundation that I've been connected with, SAVA, since 1979, and we used for years eForum, which was a way of using our computers to have meetings, because some of us were in Alaska, some in India, and so on, and we had meetings not in real time. And they were very interesting, but after a while, the affect in our relationship disappeared. And it started to, some of the deeper threads that kept us together started to be unwound just because of the medium through which we were communicating. So I think we've just got to stay very open. And I've tried to play with television as one of these issues. What I see is, as I try to go near the power nexus of the world society, it's hard pushing, just as we've been talking about before, because you're trying to bring something in that is undercutting the systems that are supporting it. And I mean, I tried, I really tried, but I've gotten a little discouraged. So I think that, though, since it is so much of an unknown, it's a creative moment for all of us to play. I don't think it's the time to throw up our hands and say we don't understand, because nobody else does either. And as much as the people are trying to socialize it to rip it off, we're seeing how many people are undercutting that process, and it may be a major democratization process that nobody's going to be able to control, and that's a very exciting possibility. That's as far as I can go at this moment.
Well, the thing that occurs to me is that this democratization, that it's an effort to decentralize, but at the same time, the paradox is that everybody could kind of be together in one moment. So I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But it seems like a revolution in...
It's hard to know, because our mind socializes that stuff so fast and turns it into something that doesn't scare us and doesn't change us. You know, it's hard to know how quickly we will do it in.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. I guess the thing that comes to my mind also is perhaps you could talk a little bit more about what it's like to work with the medium of television, because, for instance, talking with Michael Toms in Killarney, I interviewed him actually for KGNU, and he was talking about the benefits of radio and the ability of it to convey the oral tradition and activate the imagination. And when you're working with the medium of television, even though you're reaching, in some sense, you think, a much broader audience, at least from the American perspective, there's that quality of habitual passivity and so on. How do you work when you're on television, Ram Dass, to activate yourself and your audience?
I had a very interesting moment many, many years ago. I can't remember how many, but it was back probably in the late 70s, early 80s. I was doing a television interview with a fellow named Lomax in Los Angeles, who has since died. And you're told when you're doing an interview to look at the interviewer. But I turned and I took the red light over the camera and I made it the third eye of the individual. And I looked into the middle of the camera instead of focusing on the front of the camera, which news commentators do because they're reading off the screen there. I focused in the middle. And they got about 200 letters that week saying, who was that guy? He was inside my head. And I thought, my, isn't that interesting as a vehicle? That I don't think we know how to use television because we keep disempowering it through the kind of homogenization motivation, and the technology is too ponderous still. I can't tell you how many times I go into a studio to do a show, and I start, and they say, hold it, the lighting isn't quite right, excuse me, take it again. And I'm not an actor, you know, you're just saying, I've had the most wonderful experience in my, hold it, okay. I've had the most wonderful experience, hold it. I've had the most, you know, and after a while, it turns into another vibration. It's a different thing. It's coming from a different energy space.
Mm-hmm.
And what I very rarely had the opportunity to be in a television studio where I have not been totally at the mercy of the technology. And that, and not only that, and that's after you've gotten in there when you're at the mercy of the financial people first. So you're running through a series of obstacles to get to the point where you could share truth. Mm-hmm. I remember once seeing an interview show that very much impressed me. Allen Ginsberg was being interviewed by, I don't know who it was, Phil Donahue or somebody like that. And he walked onto the stage with his backpack and he looked like he was just on the street. And I remember how jarring it was to me because everybody else in the whole game was made up to be on television and had a certain persona. And his persona didn't shake. He was deep enough in his own being. And I called him afterwards. I said, Alan, I'm really impressed. That was very touching.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a model for me about how to learn how to just be who you are.
It's very interesting because it's an interesting metaphor for the dominant culture altogether. You know, as Michael Toms was saying about if you are finding yourself moving into a different lifestyle than that which is the norm because it seems to fit more your own heart need or your own soul need, and you're moving toward the margins, whether you like it or not, that you have that sense of the dominant culture and then the need to ground yourself very deeply enough in your own personal...
But the cultivation of compassion means that you also appreciate what the mainstream consciousness is about and why those people are the way they are. And instead of making them into them, they're that part of us. I mean, the pseudopod is out from the thing, doing its thing, but it's still connected to the cell, you know, to the cellular structure. And I think that that's part of what compassion is to realize there's no them. This is just, we all have our parts to play in systems that are interdependent. And I feel very much part of a system of which Bob Dole is part. It's just the question of where us keeps moving. And as long as I don't define it into a polarization, there is a real chance the whole organism can move together.
Yeah, I was thinking more of Alan just kind of moving onto the stage, you know, in his normal being, you know, without having particularly... maybe a kind of challenging aspect about that. I know one of the things Abbie Hoffman used to experiment with was the kind of épaté le bourgeois, you know, like let's do something outrageous in order to stimulate a very self-conscious.
And Alan has that in him. I mean, the Beats always had that kind of challenge to the system in it that I think is I think Alan probably doesn't have that so much now because that, as compassion develops, that one is just not a functional thing. Why would you want to do that? Like the Dalai Lama says, why would I be angry at the Chinese? It's not functional.
Well, we're going to have an opportunity here exactly to follow up on that next week because Alan's the celebration at Naropa Institute from the 2nd to the 9th of July is going to bring together Alan and a number of the poets, you know, who've also gone through similar transformations. And so let's, in the meantime, take a call here from Bob. Bob, you're on the air.
Don,
I'm sorry.
Don Duncan, it's Don Duncan.
Oh, hey, Don, it comes up as Bob here. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Don.
I have a question for Ram Dass, just a question, although there are many specifics I would love to get into, just for the pleasure of sharing information. The general question that I have is, what is your take on alternative community in terms of a possible honest alternative in terms of quality of living, and perhaps a part of the solution as opposed to a part of the problem.
Boy, first of all, Duncan, you have a really good audience out here. I mean, I very rarely get on a show where there's this much literate Colin. This is great.
I'm delighted to hear you say that, because I think KGNU really is one of the unique public radio stations. Yeah. Without being provincial.
This is a very mature dialogue. I mean, yeah. I love it. I love who I'm talking to out there. Yeah. I think that alternative communities are potential role models for the game. And I think that they are great experimental situations for us to examine a lot of our ideals when they're made manifest. I mean, when we started alternative communities back in the 60s, we had a model of how they would work. But the predicament was that conflicting with that was our tremendous new sense of empowerment of our individualism or individuality. And it's hard to run a community when you have only individuals. There has to be the sense of surrender into the common good as well. And that has to be a free and voluntary act. And we weren't quite ready to do that, so that there are a lot of them mired down in psychological free-for-alls after a while. Now I think they're more sophisticated. I think that experimental communities and alternative lifestyles, and like I work in with aging, I'm doing a book on aging now, and the whole thing of intergenerational living systems and systems that don't isolate older people from the rest of society. One starts out as an experiment, and when it has power and it feeds people, it spreads like wildfire. And when it's too scary to the society, some of the idealistic communities were in the 40s, 30s, 20s, they get wiped out because they're too scary about sexual freedom, things like that.
Don, are you there?
I'm here.
You're still there, yeah. I had gotten the wrong line. Sorry about calling you Bob there. Bob's still on the line, and we're going to get to him in a minute. But now that I recognize your voice, now that you've spoken, do you have anything to say with Ram Dass here about patterns of settlement of our existing community? For instance, the kind of things you've been involved with out there in North Boulder, and the choice of whether or not to have a large mega store, a Safeway, that creates a certain kind of psychic environment as opposed to a smaller store on the Alfalfa's or Ideal model. I know you've been involved with that. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, just briefly, it seems to me that the very things that the folks who have made the very difficult and challenging choice with regard to moving away from conventional society, so to speak, and moving to an alternative community of one sort or another, that it's being reflected, their viewpoint and their feelings and their challenges, in what's going on within conventional society as regards actual problems that come up and the old paradigm that is still being brought forth to attempt to deal with the problems that exist, versus the new paradigm, which is really an old paradigm that has to do with true community. And it just seems like a never-ending story, if you will. And I think it is the never-ending story, and it'd be interesting to hear Ram Dass comment on that as well. I do feel that there's a real urge back to community, and that it's going back to the future, if you will.
Let me frame this just real briefly for you, Ram Dass. On the local side, we have an issue here of whether or not to go back to what they're calling neo-traditional neighborhood kind of settlement, or whether to move ahead with, say, mall-based or shopping center-based kind of efficiency models that we've been working with in suburbia for the last, say, 25 years. And that sometimes they call it the new urbanism, sometimes they call it neo-traditional neighborhoods, but an attempt within the fabric of how we live now, without going as far as alternative communities, to kind of reintroduce structures that invite community rather than isolation.
I think it's a brilliant dialogue, and I'm really happy the community's having that, because it faces us with the myths of progress, that progress is good and large is better.
Right.
And it deals with small is beautiful, but also it can't be naive, because small can also be oppressive and coercive and stifle individual creativity. So it's a dialogue. You're absolutely right. It's a dialogue that continues to go on and on and on. About 2 months ago, I gave a keynote in Los Angeles on Huxley's 100th birthday. And I spoke about Huxley's Island as opposed to his Brave New World. because in Ireland he has a community that is, he sees as unstable because it can't handle the outer forces of the world around it. They were too coercive, and with this may be the situation for you as well. But he also saw that a community based on reasonableness and initiation and the right kind of education and collaborative love can serve as an important model into the world, even though it may get lost after a moment.
Well, Don, thanks very much. Let's get Bob on the line here. You've been so patient. Bob, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. A few weeks ago, I was flipping through some radio stations just for fun, and I heard a Christian guy on a Christian radio station pretty much preaching to people that they should avoid any kind of psychic experiences, and you know, the way I took it, he was telling people to avoid religious experiences. And, you know, those of us that have knowledge about truth and love, you know that that's certainly not what Jesus was trying to get across. And so, you know, what I wonder is if you've made any speeches or lectures to clergies, you know, the teachers of the Christian people, because they're trying to do the right thing, you know, but I feel that they're all pretty lost and they're too afraid of everything. But, you know, it really sickened me and made me mad when I heard that, you know, and, you know, people that know should maybe be trying to, you know, get the teachers of these other people to open their eyes up. You know, I don't know if there's any hope, but have you had any luck?
It's an interesting issue. I've certainly spoken with them, and there are ways in which we can meet around our love of the direct teachings of Christ without getting lost in the Jesus story or getting lost in Christianity, which tends to be somewhat oppressive.
Yeah.
Recently I gave a lecture to the a conservative Jewish community university in Los Angeles in Beverly Hills. And as I was born a Jew, this was an interesting moment for somebody named Ram Dass. And what I pointed out was that I was forced by the halakhic laws to assess the visions that I had had and the direct experiences as to their validity, as to whether or not they agreed with Moses and what he had seen. And the fact that I might have had a vision that was different than that made me defined as a false prophet, and that that was a technical thing, and that I was not ready to give up the sense of my own intuitive validity of something, because that's what all religions are based on anyway. And I was not turning it over to a book or another person. But in that sense, I ended up as a false prophet in the system. And I think that that's something your point is well taken, that an institution that is based on a traditional interpretation is going to be threatened by new information, so that all the saints are dead. All the visionaries are dead. That's the only safe way for an institution to stabilize itself. Because otherwise, if Christ comes today, he'd probably turn over. I'd like to tell a very quick story. It takes a minute. Do we have time?
Yes, we do. We have about 3 minutes.
Okay. There's a great guy named Milton Friedman. He's not the economist. He's this guy who writes speeches in the White House for a while. And Milton got a call one day and said, "Is this Milton Friedman, Dr. Milton Friedman?" He said, "Yes." They said, well, they thought it was the other Milton Friedman. They said, "Well, we represent a church in California that has a lot of excess funds, and we wonder if you could help advise us as to how to invest them." So Milton Friedman, my friend, said, "Have you considered giving them to the poor?" In which the church answered, "Is this the real Milton Friedman?" To which Milton Friedman answered, "Is this the real church?"
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Bob, do you have any final comment?
Well, you know, I just think it's real obvious that people are waking up, you know, all over the world, and it's just a real shame that, you know, so many people, you know, masses of people are misled.
Yeah, but you got to realize those are all stages and transitions and roots of fear. I think it is unfortunate, but it's the way the human system works. And you've got to see that into Christianity is coming a lot of the new movements in which people are speaking in tongues and coming. That's all part of a process that's forcing the Pope to squirm a little bit on his throne and reconsider his position as well.
Yeah, Bob, we might share with you one of the things that happened at that conference in Killarney was Elizabeth Sartoris, the ethnobiologist, gave a presentation. She's written a book on Gaia, and she quoted, to speak of Christ, the section from The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky called The Grand Inquisitor, where Christ does come back a second time, and this time he's actually condemned to death by the church on the grounds that the gospel of freedom and responsibility and authenticity that he's preaching is unwelcome to the people, that they really do want to be told what to do and how to think, and therefore, in the name of the people, he's condemned to death a second time. And that's basically part of human nature that we all need to work with compassion, as Ram Dass is saying. So Ram Dass, we have about a minute here. The one thing I want to ask you about, a very funny thing happened in 1974 when I was introducing you. I quite ingenuously said, and the next person is Ram Dass, formerly Richard Alpert. And you kind of joked a little later in the panel saying, I seem to be the only one here with two names. And I understand that now you're starting to use your name, Richard Alpert, again a bit. And I thought maybe this might be a nice way to end, kind of bring things full circle as we were talking.
Actually, the name that in the recent newspaper was Reuven Ben Chaim Yosef, a.k.a. Ram Dass. So there's a third one coming through.
Terrific.
So I realize I have no name. So any name seems to be whatever's functional is fine with me.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and ramdass.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at ramdass.org. We can then continue to share what Ram Dass has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.